From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, a bit of a change from Governor Andrew Cuomo. He just did his daily briefing, usually starts at 11:30, as he did today. And this was one of his shortest daily briefings. Could reflect the changing nature of the pandemic in this state. We're down to about 35 deaths in a 24-hour period, one of the lowest numbers New York State has yet reported. And the governor, as you just heard from our Randy Gordman, is confirming that tomorrow is the beginning of Phase 3 in the Rochester-Finger Lakes region. Now, center stage for that is indoor dining. Doesn't mean that restaurants will be able to open with a full set of tables. It's going to have limited capacity, but you can eat indoors in restaurants starting tomorrow in this region. And so that is a big change. And the governor says that they continue apace with the phased reopening with no plans to change that, barring a spike in cases. They are watchful and they're testing more and hoping to trace all cases. That is the update from the governor. Now, this is a chance for us today to continue our series of conversations with the candidates for office who are going to be on the ballot. And I say going to be on the ballot. You've probably seen some of the ballots if you're voting by mail for June 23rd in the special or primary elections. Earlier in this cycle, we had a chance to talk to a couple of the candidates in the Democratic primary for the 137th Assembly District seat following the retirement of longtime Assemblyman David Gant. This hour is a chance to talk to another of the candidates in that race. It's County Legislator Ernest Flagler Mitchell, who is on the line with us now. Ernest, thanks for making the time. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Very good. Well, this is a chance, I think, for you to continue a further introduction, though, of course, the community, I think, knows you pretty well, and you've served for a number of years in the legislature. But for those who don't know you well, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, your work background, and why you decided to run for this seat?
Thank you. Thank you, Evan. It's always a pleasure to come on when invited, and thank you all for coming back to allow me to speak community. You know, a little bit about myself. I am a husband, a father of eight, a grandfather of five, a minister, a retired firefighter, as well as the assistant minority leader of the Monroe County Legislature. And while in the legislature, you know, Evan, I am the author of the Safe Storage Gun Bill, as well as the person who put together the Bryce Law that we was able to get passed. And I was the point person here for the Paid Family Leave Act that we got passed earlier in my political career. I was responsible for getting business owners to get on board with paid family leave. They asked me to get three businesses. I went and got nine. And so, you know, we see the outcome of that. We was able to get that done. A few things that I would like to focus on is our broken educational system, as well as small business and entrepreneurial startups, as well as mental health in our communities. And those three things I would like to focus on, because we got to destroy the school-to-prison pipeline that is sending so many of our young black and brown children to prison, as well as, you know, when we want to start up business, we have to have money and capital. So we want to be able to fight to be able to start up businesses so that folks can be able to have jobs and hire folks in the communities to be able to work and have a decent living wage job. And as a firefighter, a retired firefighter, I know more than anybody the importance of mental health, coming off of fire trucks, going into families' houses of loved ones who are having problems breathing, shootings, fires themselves, sometimes mental health arrests. I could see the effects on the families. And a lot of times, those families don't get no mental health services to help them cope with the problems at hand. So that's a little bit about me. And, you know, I'm willing to take any questions, Evan. And once again, Thank you for bringing me on.
Sure. Well, and I'm glad you talked about some of your priorities. So let's wade into some of those more specifically. So when you talk about a broken educational system, obviously there's been a big debate in this community that continues over how to change the course. Now, there's a new superintendent, Leslie Myers Small, who there's a lot of hope for her tenure there. But there's concern over a many years problem, whether it's fiscal mismanagement, results of the district, et cetera, here. And I'm curious to know, first of all, if you go to Albany, What is your view, Ernest, of the kinds of solution? I mean, this is a community that's talked about a state takeover. This is a community that's talked about, debated, you know, essentially removing a school board that was duly elected. What do you think needs to happen specifically?
Yeah, for me, I think we have to reset this whole system. This system, the educational system we're dealing with, is cultural and it's generational now. To be able to fix it, we must reshape it, make it look different. So few things I'm thinking that would work is, one, I believe that the superintendent should become a strong superintendent, meaning that should be elected by the people. Why? Because one of the problems we see is that every other year we're getting a brand new superintendent, right? And so I believe that if you have a superintendent that have a 5-year term, okay, that it takes 5 years to see if a plan can be executed with results. I believe that we will get more out of that than having a school board select our superintendent. Second thing I believe need to take place is that we need to have district seats for school board members. If most of the people on the school board live in the more stable neighborhoods, where are the representatives of the folks whose children is in poverty-stricken areas? So I believe we need to have those two in place. And another thing I believe we have to look at is making sure that we have cultural relevant pedagogy when we're teaching. Our teachers need to have it as well as us teaching our students, because there are cultural differences that is in the mind of our teachers as well as some of our students. And we need to be able to know how to educate the child that is before us as they is, not making excuses of poverty. We have to be able to educate families mm-hmm. and children. So I believe that those are some very strong and out of the box, right, mm-hmm. thoughts that many people don't think about. But I believe that those are some of the things that need to take place.
And you talk about a school-to-prison pipeline. Well, let's talk a little bit about the debates that are roiling our community and across the country following the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Let me ask you directly, do you support on any police level, local police, state police, et cetera, do you support the movement to defund police?
No. And most people in my community don't support defunding the police. What we support is destroying the culture that the police have. What we support is making sure that when they're training, they treat us just like they treat African Americans just like they would treat Caucasians. That's what we support. To defund police departments, many of our folks call police to come into the neighborhoods. And so they get the most of their calls from our neighborhoods. It's all about the interaction, because our police is not bad police. And from 2016, you know, I was one of the first African-American elected officials to stand up with Black Lives Matter. One of the first. Actually, myself and Vince Felder was the first to stand up with Black Lives Matter. We marched. We advocated for change in policies and procedure. Because let me tell you, Evan, the biggest issue we deal with when it comes to racism is white privilege, policy, and power. Those are three things we deal with. So I don't think defunding police is the answer.
So let me follow that up by asking this, Ernest. I'm, you know, as a member of the news media, trying to not only report on the various proposals out there, but also understand the pain and the urgency of this moment. There is an activist community that is very strong across the country. There's obviously one here in Rochester. The leaders of the activist community and many of those who march with them and follow them are calling for defunding the police. It seems that what you're saying is there is a diversity of views within the Black community on defunding police, that this is not just a monolithic call among Black Americans to defund police, but there is a reform necessary of police. Is that fair? Is that right?
We all agree on reform.
Okay.
But how that reform look is where we're at, right? We, like you said, we are all together on reform. But if you go down the street, if you walk with me one day, Evan, and I'm inviting you to come walk with me one day.
I'd be happy
to
do it,
and we talk
yes.
to some of my constituents, especially some of our elders. They're not in favor of defunding police. They're in favor of the culture being changed in the police department. You know, money is not the problem. It's the way they treat us is the problem.
How do you start to fix that? You know, is it training? Is it recruiting? Is it different rules? Is it the, sort of the tactical or military style gear that police have on hand? Is it something else?
Well, the way you fix that, you know, once again, like I said earlier, the problem we have is power and policy tied into white privilege. If we want to truly change a system, we have to look at African Americans like they're a full human being. I always say this, that when Abraham Lincoln fought and won the Civil War, he was murdered shortly after that. And one thing that never took place was a conversation in this country on how black and white can see each other as equals. We still deal with post-traumatic slave syndrome on both sides, white side as well as black side. Some white privilege believe that white privilege can treat black folks any way they want. And I'm not talking all white people, and I'm not talking all black people, but we in the black community, we feel like when it comes to us standing up and using our voice, and then white society don't agree with it, what ends up happening is they want our heads. And at the end of the day, we have to represent everybody, but everybody got to be on an equal playing field. We all have to be looked at as equal and not segregated like, you know, this society is created.
Well, when you talk about post-traumatic slave syndrome, when you talk about mental health, part of the calls for police reform include this idea that, well, police are being asked to do too much, that they respond to what we sort of broadly describe as mental health calls, mental hygiene calls, et cetera, and that that should be out of the hands of police. Do you agree with that?
No, totally do not agree with that. As a firefighter, I've seen firsthand as to the importance of having police officers in an area when you have a mental health arrest. We went on a call over on Ames Street when I worked out of Engine 5. We went upstairs. It was a person with trouble breathing. However, they said that they had a mental disorder. We got there. We could not work on the person because we had that person, but we didn't know there was another person in there as well who had a mental health issue as well. So we're at the door knocking for the person to let us in. They let us in, and the person who we thought we was dealing with, that wasn't the person. The person was in the room. So when we went to knock in the room, the person burst out there. And if the person would have made a two or three more steps towards me, I would have probably had to use one of my tools to take them down. So it's important to have law enforcement there because law enforcement grabbed him before he got to me. So it's important that we have them on scene when we're talking about mental health issues, not to beat up on nobody, but to have the presence so that we can, if we have to work on a person who is irate at the time, then, you know, we could take them down and then be able to work on them. And that person was seriously in trouble, had a blood pressure of 180 over 120. They was in trouble.
Ernest, if you're elected to the New York State Assembly, do you support any measures on the state level that would change the way police prosecutions may happen? Governor Cuomo has talked about bringing in prosecutors from outside the community so as not to create any sort of conflict of interest. Obviously, this community has debated a police accountability board. The courts have had their own say about how much teeth a PAB can have. What do you support there in terms of police discipline?
I support a PAB board, and I support being able to deal with officers who take their job for granted and do what and break the rules of protecting and serving. I believe that what Governor Cuomo is speaking of having outside and independent folks coming in to do the work, I totally agree with it, because I always say that police can't police themselves. Firefighters can't police themselves. You know, certain folks, certain positions, you can't police yourself. So I agree with sweeping changes when we're talking about having to deal with breaking a culture that have seen pretty much African-Americans and folks in the inner city, you know, the treatment. We see in the treatment of them. So, yes, I believe in sweeping reforms when it comes to that.
All right, some other state priorities. If you're elected to the New York State Assembly, what kind of a health care system do you support? And do you support the New York Health Act, which would be a single-payer state system?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I want to thank Assemblyman Godfrey for being such a longtime sponsor of that, of the New York Health Act before it was even popular, right? And also I want to thank Assemblyman David Gant, because he has been a co-sponsor for a very long time also. I don't think a lot of people know that, but he has been. And as one of my first actions, if elected or when elected into office, into the seat, is I'm going to sign on to be a co-sponsor of the bill as well. And because what I believe is health care should not be a right and something that you have to worry about on a daily basis, especially in our district. Health care should be something that you should have automatically.
Talking to Ernest Flagler Mitchell, candidate for the 137th Assembly District Democratic primary, for a few more minutes. Hey, before I forget, since your opponents in the race had the chance to say so, if you want to let people know a website or a place to learn more, this is a great place to do it, Ernest.
Yes, ErnestFlaglerForAssembly.com.
Now, when you go to the Assembly, if you get a chance to vote for the New York Health Act, if you get a chance to increase funding for districts, the school districts like Rochester, you know, your voters, your opponents may ask you, how do you plan to pay for it? One of the proposals we've heard on the table that Governor Cuomo does not support, at least not right now, is a significant new tax on the so-called ultra-wealthy, billionaires, ultra-millionaires, et cetera, some kind of tax, a tiered tax at those levels. Do you support that?
Yes. I believe everybody should pay their fair share of taxes.
And do you think that there's going to be any issue in paying for a single-payer health care system?
I don't think so. I think that when we're looking at bringing in the Racinos and all these other initiatives that is supposed to generate money for our state, I believe that it can pay for some of the needs in which we need, essential needs, and one is health care, right? And so we just have to figure out when I get there on how we're going to do it and how much that would cost.
All right. I will also want to ask you before we go here to talk a little bit more about business development, particularly in all communities. And yesterday on this program, Jerome Underwood, who I suspect you know pretty well, he challenged me and other journalists to push corporations, to push the Wegmans of the world, to ask, why aren't you in Rochester? What is it about the current environment that says you should not have a single store open in so many city neighborhoods? Not just Wegmans, but others. And I told him I think he's right. We will push to get those answers. Now, you've talked about business startups. You've talked about bringing in investment and development. How does that happen now? I mean, whether it's not just, you know, the big corporations, the Wegmans of the world, but how are you going to be able to facilitate that, Ernest?
Well, I believe that the biggest issue that folks have is being able to start up their business is their capital, right? A lot of small business, they can't survive because they don't have the capital to survive. And for minority businesses, it's their startup in general. And I believe that we have to be able to find funding to be able to put programs together to help individuals open or maintain their business, especially after what the pandemic we're going through, the COVID-19. These are a lot of places won't be opening them back up. And with the big void in our city areas, when you're talking about grocery stores, I would not be surprised and I would not be against seeing us have a community grocery store that is ran and paid for, you know, by government.
You think that could happen in the near future?
We sure are going to fight for it.
And lastly, when it comes to this pandemic, there has been, I think, coupled with the civil rights movement and the protests and the demonstrations, an emphasis not just on police-community relations, but also the disparities across society, including health care. And we saw in certain cities, finally, in the last week, more testing open up in predominantly black neighborhoods or neighborhoods where there is more poverty. You know, one of the disparities across the country is the communities that have been hit the hardest often have the least, in, you know, the lower number of testing sites and healthcare resources. How are we doing in this community? How do you see the fight against the pandemic in Rochester?
You know, I got to give credit to our mayor as well as a county executive, Adam Bello, due to the fact that they have been working very close to try to put pressure on New York State to give them the funding and the testing kits to be able to test in our communities. You know, we have community testing sites now over in the heart of many of our poor neighborhoods where now folks can go and be tested for the virus or the antibodies. So I believe that they're, because they're working together, we're doing pretty good. We ain't where we need to be at, mm-hmm. though. I don't want nobody to believe that. We still have a long way to go. A lot of people still haven't been tested, but we are moving in the right direction.
Ernest Flagler Mitchell is a member of the Monroe County Legislature and a candidate for the 137th Assembly District in the Democratic primary on June 23rd. You've heard from two other candidates in that race previously, a fourth candidate in the primary. Ann Lewis has not responded to multiple invitations to join this program, but we are grateful for Ernest's time. So, Ernest, thank you. I appreciate the time, and I know we will talk again soon, sir.
Yeah. Yes, Evan, and listen, Evan, when you're ready to come out, call me up.
You know what? I'm going to make a note of this and call you sooner than later. I hope you don't regret inviting me.
Oh, no, I won't. It'll be a learning experience for you.
Yes,
trust
sir.
Me.
Yes, sir. Ernest Flagler Mitchell. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.